Welcome to the Theorist-Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and their compositions. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a graduate music theory student at Florida State University. Today I will be talking with the composer Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba, who, alongside his piece Uncharted, is the featured guest for this episode. We discuss his background, what a diverse perspective in music means, career anxiety, expression in composition, and much more. So, without further ado, this is an excerpt from Uncharted, and welcome to the TCC. Again, the music that you were just listening to is an excerpt from the piece titled Uncharted by the composer Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba, who, alongside their music, is the featured guest for this episode. That leads me to welcome Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba, also known as Paco themselves, to the program. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm doing excellent on this fine Tallahassee morning. It's pouring outside. How is it over in Arizona?
It's in the hundreds.
Oh, so goodness.
It's nice and hot, but actually what's kind of funny is everyone around me has been saying, fall's finally here. It's cooling down. And I'm just like, we're still in 100 degree weather.
Yeah, okay. Well, I take back my griping. I'd much rather have a dreary 75 degree day than a 100 degree Arizona day, no offense, but as we talked about before, Paco is fine, right?
Correct. Yeah. Most everyone calls me Paco. For legal reasons, I like to just throw in Francisco Javier just in case someone else needs to find me. But yeah, for the most part, everyone, like my family growing up, everyone's called me Paco. Even my students call me Dr. Paco. So yeah. Paco's fine.
Just checking. All right. Well, how about you go ahead and introduce yourself personally, professionally, academically, however you choose.
Sure. So like I said, I'm Dr. Paco. I have a passion for teaching, performing, and composing. I'm a clarinetist, international performer, and self-published composer. I currently reside in Phoenix, Arizona, where I teach a studio of almost 40 students. I perform with our local symphony orchestra. I run a small business selling my sheet music and composing music for various musicians and ensembles.
40?
Yeah, it used to be right at 40, and I kind of had to cut it down because I was kind of teaching myself to death.
40 is crazy. That's a lot. A lot of students, all clarinet.
Yeah, a majority was clarinet at that point. I also teach piano, and sometimes I teach composition as well. That one kind of is a little less frequent, but sometimes you get those little, you get students that are all of a sudden they're like, "Hey, I wrote this thing. Is it a thing?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you just did a thing. That's really cool. Let's talk about it."
Sure. What's the I'm just picking at some of the things that you said. Small business selling your sheet music, is that through your website or do you have like a separate publisher? What's going on with that?
Yeah, so kind of when I decided to start selling my music as a composer, I wrote a blog post way back when I was, gosh, I would have been in either middle school or high school, or just getting into high school. I just started like being interested in composing. It was actually John Mackey's blog post about his journey with self-publishing. And so that always stuck with me, and I stuck, or I just kind of, put it in the back of my mind, and I was like, well, if I ever become a composer in the future, which probably won't happen, I want to be self-published because I want to be like in charge of my music. And so yeah, when my kind of career started developing, I found myself like, okay, I'm ready to sell my music. And then yeah, I set up my website and I do all the printing, I do all the score editing, I do all the binding, I do all the mailing. And so yeah, it's like a definitely become a small business in the sense of like it's another part of kind of my music career I wasn't expecting to kind of be in charge of, but I'm happy and it's kind of very fulfilling, kind of full circle moment for my younger self reading that blog post.
Very cool. Very cool. I could go down a whole rabbit hole about that, about the whole e-commerce side of the music business when it comes to that. Personally, I get like a couple dollars every month from Sheet Music Plus because of some pop music arrangements that I
Nice.
have published up there. They're not fantastic. But
Oh, okay.
from many years ago, but just yeah. Anyways, I find that stuff very, very fascinating. We talk about yourself as a small businessman, of course, a performer with a rather sizable studio. I don't think universities have that big of a studio, and if they do, they have lots of different assistants. So that's quite a lot of work. But let's bring it back around to you as a composer. How would you describe yourself as a composer and largely your music?
That is a great question. And I've had several people ask me, like, when they approach me to write music for them, I'm like, well, how would you describe your style? Like, what's your genre that you fit into? And we had kind of talked about in our preliminary conversations about how I definitely struggle with that question in the sense that a lot of my music, it's hard to pinpoint, at least for me, where I fit into a genre. And so the best way that I can describe my music and how I am compositionally is kind of just talk about my upbringing with music and what
Sure.
I've listened to. And I think like all of that kind of has slowly seeped into my brain. And that's now as I write, like that's what kind of comes out. So I grew up in a religious family. And so I grew up listening to a lot of hymns and church music and a lot of like Christian pop. And so that's definitely like in my brain. And then on top of that, I have a lot of kind of what's called OPM or original Filipino music that I listened to growing up. And that kind of seeped into my brain. And then when I went to, I would say when I went to study music in college, studying Western music, going through like the Oxford, music history book, definitely, starting with Gregorian chant and then ending up all the way in like kind of modern music and surrealism and all that stuff and 12 tone, I definitely gravitated and kind of pulled in a lot of those different genres, like kind of every aspect of studying through them and all the different music. I just kind of absorbed everything and just loved all the music. So I just love like I love every genre, and even outside of classical, quote unquote, classical music or art music, even just pop music and rock and like thinking about like punk music and emo music. Like that was definitely like in high school, everyone kind of goes through that stage. And so all of that just kind of seeped into me and my ears, and I just kind of kept grabbing all the different things that I liked and make me feel happy and kind of make me feel fulfilled in music. And so yeah, I kind of take that and then inject it into my music, but with the sense of because I have so many interests and so many different genres that I like and listen to, It's easy for me when I'm writing for someone, I kind of try to tailor it to what they like to listen to and what they like to play. I have a lot of kind of things I can draw from when someone says, I really like John Cage and experimental music. I'm like, okay, well let's explore that. Or like if they're just like, I really like Katy Perry, or like, I really like Lady Gaga or Beyonce. I'm just like, okay, let's explore that in art music,
Sure. And I want to attach on to at the release of this episode here with Dr. Paco, the previous episode, 2 weeks prior would have been, or is, not would have been, is the second TCC roundtable where myself and two others, Albert Wheeler and Dr. Pamela Morales, we talk about the classical canon and issues in and around that. Now, I'm not going to rehash all that, but you talk about how your upbringing, you came from, and let's load up some terms here, a non-traditional background in that you're multifaceted. It's not just one thing, and it's certainly not just Western European art music. And so my question is what is your perspective on the intersection and playing within and outside of that classical canon? I mean, the audience can't see this because this is a podcast, but you could probably see behind me here in my workroom, I have a poster back there that says at the top, "The Great Composers," and it's all of the stereotypes that you can imagine. They are great composers, but it's also a very purposely exclusive list. So take that as you will, but I'm just asking what your thoughts are on that.
That's a great question. And as a even me, I sometimes I get uncomfortable with what's okay to say or how to describe myself. So and it's kind of funny too. Sometimes I'll just Google, I'm like, is it okay to say I'm like multiracial, or is it okay to say I'm a mixed person? And kind of the overall, it's kind of like if the person themselves is saying it about themselves, it's usually okay. So for me, I have a very diverse background in that both of my parents are immigrants, and I've grown up with three languages in our household. My dad speaks Spanish, Tagalog, which is Filipino, and English, and then my mom speaks Tagalog and English. And so, at one point, my grandfather was living with us, and he spoke Spanish. And so, I grew up with that kind of aspect of different cultures kind of colliding, even just in my own household. And with that, comes different forms of art that get presented. So, I grew up listening to a lot of kind of Spanish flamenco music, and that also is another kind of part of my kind of self that I'm trying to rediscover, is like my Spanish heritage, but also for the longest time I'd kind of connected more with my Filipino heritage, and then also just trying to figure out what it means for me to be an American. So like that's also just a whole nother loaded thing. And then on top of all of that, kind of going into music school, and then not kind of being blind to all of the preferences that are made towards certain composers, I guess you can say. And so, when I kind of when I was going through school, we studied, Hildegard Bingen, which is like, they're like token, like, hey, we have a woman in our book, and it's just like, okay, or like we have Clara Schumann, and that's our diversity. And so I think,
And if it's really progressive, Amy Beach.
And so I think it's getting better now. I know like there's a lot of different programs and things popping up, and new developments. And I kind of hear from my students like, oh, I'm studying popular music now, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. Like I don't know what that entails, but that's like really cool that that's something you can now study. I always think of to like when the academia kind of absorbed jazz into it too, is like kind of one of the stages. I'm like, oh, are we absorbing pop music now, and kind of how is that going to look in a few years? But I think when it comes to my experience of learning music, I did learn the Western canon, and I am grateful for knowing that music, because a lot of that like has inspired me and has influences me. But the other kind of flip side of it is, because I come from a diverse background, I do have other kind of areas of music that kind of I don't realize that other people don't have kind of knowledge of. One good example is I took a a music history pedagogy class. And so one of the courses that I kind of developed in that class was music of Southeast Asia. And so kind of I got to kind of do a little bit of a section on Filipino music and original Filipino music, and just kind of showing what kind of music the Philippines has to offer to my class. And everyone was just like, I had no idea this music existed. I had no idea any of these artists existed. I had no idea, like, you know, that style of music exists. And so it kind of, that was my first instance of like, oh yeah, I listened to music that not a lot of people have ever experienced in their life. And so I was like, how do I, as a composer, how do I highlight that more in my own music? Or how do, you know, what can I do to help highlight my own Filipino heritage and then help that be a stepping stone for other people to find, you know, more music in that genre?
Sure, sure. And thank you for taking that on. I know, so as you said, sometimes this can be a difficult thing to completely express. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point.
Yeah.
Like the
for... Sorry, I blanked out right there. Go on.
No,
go on.
You're fine, because the, you know, it's strange in that when you are someone who I kind of has a lot of like a diverse background like me, where I have Filipino heritage, I have Spanish heritage, and I was born in the United States. Like, how do I kind of, I have to take this, I have to like kind of toe this line of like, I don't want to misrepresent where I come from, because I technically, you know, I didn't grow up in the Philippines or I didn't grow up in Spain, but I do have like that kind of upbringing and that culture in my, like from my upbringing, but I'm not fully, like sometimes it's hard to kind of, for me to accept that I'm fully Filipino or I'm fully Spanish, or, you know, sometimes I'm fully American and some people don't believe that I'm fully American, but, you know, so
yes.
It's definitely like in, I love that in music, I found a community and I found kind of a place where I can express it in my music and I don't have to worry about what I'm saying. I can just write the music, have people play it, and kind of they can take it from there.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
And, not to disagree. No, I see what you're saying. I'm just joking around.
And it's true. I feel sometimes it's a double-edged sword when I say that, in that I found a community, and, you know, there is areas of music that still need a lot of work and a lot of people, you know, and that's also just not even in music, but in every kind of facet of the world, of just like, how do we come together and how do we kind of do that? And so I think one thing for me that has really helped is just finding that community, that pocket in music that's doesn't make me feel like I'm on the outside, you know?
You know, that's a great segue into the other subject of today, other than yourself, Uncharted. Speaking of bringing people together, I think this is a good segue into, let's talk about Uncharted, the piece that we have featured today alongside yourself. So I'm gonna let you explain it yourself, because you can certainly do it better than I can. But on your website for the program notes for this piece, Uncharted, which is for a Reed Quintet, you talk about what your rationale, or at least what the zeitgeist you were thinking of when going into writing this piece was. And it also then, you know, goes into the structure of the piece and the tone and the different timbres that are achieved. So can you talk a bit about the origins and the idea behind Uncharted?
Yeah, so Uncharted is written for Reed Quintet. I was approached by Arcane Reed Quintet to write this piece for the, actually it was 2 years ago, so the International Clarinet Association, they have a conference called Clarinet Fest, and that year's theme was our global community, past, present, future. And so when they approached me, they wanted to focus more on that future part of the theme. And so, and that's pretty much all the information they gave me. I mean, my normal thing I ask people who commission me is, you know, kind of, what pieces do you like? What composers do you like? What do you like playing? Are there any, you know, ranges and things like that? But other than that, you know, it's kind of, as far as theme, it was like future. So I sat with that for a good bit. I said, okay, what piece am I going to write about the future? Like, is it going to be about like technology and AI, or like, is it going to be other things? And then I started thinking about the other aspects of the theme of, so our global community. So I was thinking about stuff that affects the globe. And so that coupled with the future, I definitely started to feel a lot of emotions of just thinking about the future. And so I kind of jotted down a few emotions I was feeling as I just thought about the future and kind of what the future holds for the world. And yeah, so that I used those the five emotions I wrote down were panic, longing, frustration, wariness, and then optimism. So I kind of went through each movement just trying to sit with how I feel about those emotions and like what I was experiencing and what was I thinking about. And then I was like, okay, now let's capture that in music and let me try to take the listener on that journey of the emotions that I felt thinking about the future, and hopefully kind of bring up some issues in their own mind and how they feel about the future and what we can kind of do to like come together as a global community. And yeah, that was kind of how the piece came about.
Sure, thank you. Thank you. And it's interesting because it's like an adaptable premise to the listener. Like you just said, conjuring what do those emotions in someone's life mean to them about their future, those things. But if you're comfortable to do so, how about yourself? What issues are you thinking about? When you talk about global anxiety, the first thing that I think of, and this is probably a generational thing, I'm sure you can relate to this, is climate anxiety is one of the first things that comes up with climate change and the millions of issues that are arisen with that. But I like the piece significantly for its adaptable premise, but how about yourself personally? What comes to mind for you?
And that was kind of one of the more salient things I was going to bring up is, living here in Arizona, we definitely feel climate change. I think we broke the record for the most days above 100, like consecutive straight. So, we definitely live in like warm. I mean, it is the desert, but like that's kind of, breaking records every year is definitely you do see it happen. And then obviously I'm originally from California, and so it's just seeing like the how progressively worse the fire like you know the wildfires have gotten.
I
And
can't
then
believe there's a fire season in California. That's just crazy.
yeah, it's crazy and sad. And so that was one of the things I did think about. But yeah, when speaking to like the idea of adaptability, I didn't want to just kind of, write a movement that's called climate change or write a movement that's called like war or something. I wanted it to be something that can bring attention to what any person is having that anxiety about or having those emotions about. So another thing that a little bit less kind of doom and gloom, but still can feel a bit doom and gloom for musicians is, kind of finding a career in music is also can be very, your future in music. So it doesn't even have to be like something, as, big as climate change. It can be something very personal to yourself as far as like, going through music school and like what's going to happen after music school. And I think that also probably helped tie in a little bit more into the piece for myself, because now that I'm retrospectively thinking about when I was writing the piece, I just finished my doctorate. I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. Obviously, the dream is to teach at a university, and I had a little bit of a taste of it when I got to be on faculty at ASU over the pandemic, and that was like a really good experience. And then kind of after everything settled and I left ASU, I kind of was just thinking about, what is my career? What is it? What is like what's in store for me? And I kept seeing like things of there's this one composer on social media that posts like weekly updates of like composer professor positions and like composition positions, and it's just like, in the entire United States there's two positions open and there's like, 100 applications. There are probably thousands of applications, honestly. And so like, me as a musician and someone who loves teaching, it's like, okay, is, teaching at a university, is that even going to be an option for me in the future, especially with like all the programs closing? I had a good friend that their program just completely dissolved, and they, now they're out of a teaching job. And so I was like, okay, what do I do with my own career? And so I kind of focused on to kind of avoid the panic. I kind of focused on kind of things that brought me joy. And so yeah, that's where I think I went headstrong into building a studio. And then yeah, that's where I ended up with I was kind of drowning in 40 students. And then at the same time was, writing pieces for people and was realizing, hey, I do have a, I'm very fortunate in that I have a composition schedule that I kind of have to keep. Even my wife, she'll tell me okay, that's your last composite, that's your last commission you can take for this year, no more, because you will die. You're gonna burn yourself out. And so having that kind of aspect and just being multifaceted in music and just learning to accept that, and that's kind of my kind of journey with Uncharted, right? Or at least I should say one aspect, because it can constantly change. I think of, some musicians, the future can hold different things for them, whether it be injuries, or it could be health and family stuff. It's just anything, and doesn't have to be for musicians. It can be a piece that anyone can relate to, and I think that's why, for me, that piece has been really kind of cathartic and therapeutic, because I get to experience talking to audience members who they'll come up to me and just say, "Oh, I thought about X, Y, and Z," and it's different for everyone. So I'm glad that you kind of caught on to that adaptability.
Yeah, on the to speak on my own adaptability with that, or what how I perceived it was very similar to what you were just talking about. I'm in the second year of my graduate school, and that's certainly career anxiety is certainly something that I think about. And okay, I'll say it. Yeah, I also think I was weighing my options right there. I also have anxiety about my own field. Maybe this is a selfish thing to talk about. I'm not talking about music or music academia. I'm talking specifically about music theory. To put it lightly, it's not what I thought it was. What I thought it was before I went to graduate school for it is very different than what I think it is now. And a lot of those facets are not necessarily positive or forward thinking. I'm being vague because I respect my professors, peers, and institution. So, I have a fair amount of anxiety for that, and hoping to find the optimism just as you do in movement five. And so, I want to talk about those emotions along the way as we go through the different movements, to attach them, because then we can like pair the sound clips of the piece with them. It'll be really cool. So, let's talk about movement one, panic. I think it's relatively clear, not just aurally, but looking through the score, how you illustrate the idea of panic. In one sense, something that might not be immediate. Noticeable in some spots, it is because of how close the notes are, but is the harmonic panic or your incredibly tight vertical spacing with the different voices. Many times that results in stark minor seconds, major seconds, repeated lines of eighth notes of that, and then you throw them up an octave or down an octave. A lot of conflicting linear lines that vertically don't necessarily fit together, and I put fit in big quotes harmonically, so that it's very at least in my analysis brain, it's very linear thinking, not vertical thinking in that terms, because it's also driving. And the other now acute listeners will be able to notice this, but especially when you're looking at the store as score, the rhythm is absolutely just a bonkers at some point. Let me pull up here. I want to read out. So at 10 measures in, we have 14 over 8, and you have notated 2 plus 2 plus 3 plus 3 plus 2 plus 2. And later it changes, and then you start notating in the score that you want certain instruments to do a different beat or a different, yeah, a different grouping of the beats than the other. You know, like one will be 3 at one point, and the other 2 will be 2. So then it's just on top of the craziness of that, then you're further splitting it. So I am not a very good rhythmic person. That's in both analysis and performance. That's I'm also a violinist, so that adds to the that's the stereotype of the rhythm. But that's just crazy to me. And so I'm asking you generally, what were you thinking about with other than illustrating panic? Compositionally, what were you thinking about this movement? And also, because I'm just not great with rhythm, at least not to that degree, how did you conceptualize that part?
That's, you know, all really great points. And we had talked about this earlier of just like, it's so, I love that like you as a music theorist are looking at my music and these are the things you're pulling out. Cause you know, I, for so long, I kind of stayed in that compositional brain kind of writing this piece. And so looking back now retrospectively and seeing like, okay, music, like theoretically, what is this, you know, kind of what would someone see in this music? And I'm glad that you see panic because I mean, even just in the opening, you know, it's, I kind of, it might seem like random entrances, but for the quintet, they're counting like crazy to make sure that they come in together on those first initial hits. And then, yeah, you get into this weird time signature. And so kind of a little bit of a backstory to where this time signature comes from. I was listening to actually the group Rage Against the Machines. And I was just kind of like, man, I love how sometimes it's not even like, you know, their count. It's more just like a groove that they're kind of setting down. And then it doesn't really matter like the time signature or like theoretically what it looks like. It's more just how you feel it. And that's kind of where that crazy time signature come from, is I was kind of sitting at a piano and I was like, okay, let's think about what's something that sounds kind of crazy. And so I started messing around and I was like, okay, what is this groove in? How does it feel? And then I tried to like, you know, put it in 4/4, put it in, you know, 5/8, and 5/8 plus 5/8 is 7/8, or, you know, 7/8 plus 7/8. And then it made sense, the most sense to just do in the, you know, 14/8. And then, yeah, add the groupings in. And talking to the quintet too, I wanted to make sure that it made sense to them also. Because, you know, they're the ones performing it and playing it, so they need to figure out these rhythms. And surprisingly, you know, they said, actually, you know, they are not fazed by that. They just feel that rhythm, you know, they feel that how it goes. And then they're able to kind of follow each other. And then when it does get into different groupings, that's where it was a little tricky, but I tried to, you know, group the interests, so you're not alone in those groupings, you know, you have someone else kind of join you in those groupings. And then you just have to, you know, you trust in your own kind of feel of that groove. But yeah, so that's kind of where all those crazy time signature comes from. And yeah, I thought about it first horizontally, like what is the line? And then kind of, you know, as I went thinking about vertically, is that the harmony that I want? Or like, is that kind of the sound I want there? Or is that, you know, is that dissonance, quote unquote, correct in my mind?
Desired. Is it desired?
Yes. Yeah. And so, yeah. And the biggest thing is just when I'm writing this, or when I hear this, and then eventually like when someone plays it, can you feel the panic in the music? And I think I hopefully captured that, and it seems like I did.
Yes, you did. You did. And okay, this is coming from a string player, but personally, in my opinion, a reed quintet has a much brighter and harsher sound than if you did this for a string quartet. Mm. So I feel like there you can have that in your face emotion maybe a little bit easier with the timbre of the instruments than if you did it for a piano trio string quartet. quintet, whatever. Again, you may just, I'm sure you're very partial to woodwinds, of course, but
Yeah, I mean, the writing for the Reed Quintet was like super fun, and all the musicians are an Arcane Reed Quintet. They're like, amazing players, and kind of just took what I said and I took what I wrote and kind of took it to the next level, which is just, that's all you can ask for. And but I think, writing for strings is it has it comes with it, it kind of comes with its own kind of baggage.
Sure.
Like, I've yet to write a string quartet, mainly because, there's, again, a lot of baggage that comes with writing string quartet, and there's plenty of good ones out there. But and plenty of other great ones that are being written now. So, but yeah, I think when it came to writing for the Reed Quintet, I had a little bit of, I kind of had a little cheat code. One, I play two of the instruments, clarinet and bass clarinet, and then the other instruments are, one, I have really good friends in who plays instruments, and then I've just spent a lot of time playing in, like, orchestra and band and stuff, and so have a little bit more intimate knowledge of those instruments and how they work together.
Sure. Totally understandable. I personally would find a string quartet a lot more approachable, but surprise, it's because I've played in them. So it, like come see, come saw when it comes to that. On the idea of panic tying into the theme of everything, I don't think it's very hard to see. And again, like aurally, but like intellectually, when we're talking about big things in the world or our own personal world, it's not too hard to describe what panic means in the context of this. So I think we're going to move past that philosophical discussion with that because it's a very intense, hopefully momentary, sometimes prolonged feeling of being overwhelmed and stressed and worried. I don't think that's too hard for people to imagine, but I do want to especially talk about movement two with longing. So movement two, like with any, I'm not going to say ones that aren't contrasting are bad, but like with any good multi-movement chamber work, you have strong contrasts between the movements, especially adjacent movements like movement two, longing. I not to disagree with like your own compositional thing, but it serves almost more as an interlude because it is so short compared to the other movements, and it is completely different than its adjacent movements. And another thing that I found fascinating, what I really loved, is the we're talking about harmonic structures and linear vertical writing. This one is highly vertical. I would say, with the exception of melodic fragments where a specific instrument will break off, it's almost entirely vertically written. In that, I was thinking about, I was taking a look at this while I was at, in my office yesterday, or at the graduate assistant office. And I was, because I just got done preparing for the transformational theory class, I was thinking about like, oh, that Roman numeral go there. Oh, that Roman, actually, what Neo-Romanian transformation? Like it was, it's highly tonal, even if not everything adheres specifically. I'm trying to think about how did you achieve the feeling of longing and what does that mean in the context of all this? Because I think about how it's like the calm after the storm, and its harmony is simple and like logical enough that it's Yeah, it's just calming compared to what the listener just went through. So I guess that wasn't a fully formed thought, but can you go ahead and talk about the second movement?
Yeah, definitely. I love it. And yes, it is a good kind of description of it, is that it's kind of an interlude into the kind of, and for the listeners, the structure of like the whole thing is it's primarily a taka. I mean, I put like fermatas after each movement, and I kind of specify, whether it's a long fermata or short fermata. I wanted the movements to more flow seamlessly together. So if we talk about theory analysis, in the at the last moment of the first movement, I believe there's like a D in the bassoon, and then it resolves to like a G in the second movement. There's a good 5-1 moment, and so and kind of how I sent it to you, unfortunately, I had to send it to you in kind of broken up movements, so you don't get that kind of nice seamless transition from like the first movement to the second movement.
Oh, I see it. Yes. I see it. Yes. Yeah.
I kind of was thinking about, okay, how do I get out of this like crazy panic? And usually what happens, for me at least, is like I will have that kind of moment of calm. And so I was trying to think of like longing and having like, how do I capture that in music? And what's nice too is that even the reed quintet, when they got the movement, they were like, we don't know like the direction to take this movement, like where, how do we, like what do you want us to do, where is the line flowing? And I was like, that's the point, is that it, these kind of big, these just chords that kind of start the movement, they're that, it's something that's trying to start and just can't kind of go forward. And then you get, when the instruments kind of move, when certain solo instruments kind of pull away from that vertical kind of chord movement, that's, kind of them yearning and like kind of almost trying to pull the rest of the ensemble into something more horizontal again, like more like has direction, can kind of move forward. And so that's kind of one idea I had, and like kind of what I tried to do with the texture there, is that idea of like, you have these kind of soloists trying to pull the pull the ensemble along, and kind of yearning for that next thing, that next kind of melody or that next harmony, or moving to the next idea. And then the other kind of tie into that is, yeah, it's this idea of like, sometimes you kind of, it's that idea of like kind of staring off into the distance, and kind of like if you're on like a ship in the middle of the ocean, and you saw like an island in the distance, like all you could do is, kind of keep paddling your boat and looking at the island, like, and just kind of like trying to get there, and trying to
I assume that's how it fits into the narrative of dealing with certain issues in your life in the future.
yeah, you can't predict the future, right? You can't like know what's going to happen. You can only kind of like think of things that are going to happen. And at the same time, yeah, you're also kind of trying to like pull all these aspects of your life forward, and trying to pull out of this kind of panic. And it's like, okay, so we are alive, and we still have to, live our life. So how do we kind of keep going forward and pull away from some of the craziness that's around us? And yeah, just kind of seeing, sometimes just seeing your dream in the distance, and seeing that like career you want, or seeing that future you want, or that kind of ideal thing, and trying, seeing it in the distance, and not being able to kind of quite grasp it quite yet.
Sure. That brings us to movement three, which, if I'm not mistaken, is anger.
So this one's frustration, and I did kind of,
Frustration.
yeah, I did kind of, actually, I kind of tested a different word and different emotions that kind of ended, thesaurus.com, and
Yeah.
like trying to figure out what did kind of fit in kind of when I finished writing the music. So I think initially it might have been like anger or rage or something like that. And then I was like, actually, it's just frustrating, the
Yeah, they certainly are different flavors of ice cream, those different words. So frustration. going on how you were compositionally expressing it, of course, it's a faster tempo. Quarter note equals 120. It's in, it's just the thing that I noticed how you were emphasizing frustration is very much in rhythm, but it's in a different way than the first movement. In that, for a lot of this, or at least the beginning, it's in 4/4, which is a really typical meter, especially for 120 beats per minute. That's like kind of almost pop music tempo. But you also, for the most part, had pretty traditional beat emphasis, but it was really strong and harsh. Which I love that way of illustrating frustration, especially in contrast to the beginning, because like the beginning was like craziness, kind of. No, it was with the rhythm at least, and with the harmony. Now, I didn't really do so much of a harmonic analysis with the frustration, but it was very, for a good chunk of movement three, it's very square in terms of its rhythm, but then it starts to unravel as a lot of frustration does. And then there's a breaking point where it goes even faster.
Yes.
And then the texture gets crazy. So, like, it went from a very, and don't take this as an insult, but a very standard 4/4 aggressive movement. And then it started losing it got lost in the sauce a little bit, just as we all do in frustration. So I'm sure that I well, I'm sure, I'm guessing that's where you were going compositionally and philosophically with this movement, but can you talk about it a bit?
Yes. Definitely, when I was thinking about frustration, you have that kind of driving 4/4 that's just like we're in the strict time. There's the box and you can stay only in the box, right? And the frustration is trying to get out of that box. And so, it starts off with those kind of running 16ths, and then it just stops abruptly, and then kind of you get an interjection, and then it tries to ramp up again. And then it's kind of everyone, every kind of inch, every part person in the quintet is, I kind of thought of it as if they were trying to vie for their kind of voice to be heard above everyone else. Because that's another issue that kind of you think of in the future, or when you think of the future, sometimes with good intent, or even though there people have good intentions, sometimes when we all try to have our voice heard, then no one's heard, So it's like if everyone's screaming, no one's listening kind of idea. And so I definitely was feeling that kind of while I was writing it. I was like, I can't for maybe I've blacked it out, but I can't pinpoint the exact kind of instance in history that I was thinking of that happening. But there's plenty of kind of anyone can slot in anything that's kind of happening right now, even right now, with kind of November coming up and whatever. So the yes, I definitely was like, okay, let's start a bit kind of that idea of here's the box. Now let's can we break out of it? And when we do break out of it, what happens? If we all break out of it all at the same time, and kind of if we're all just yelling at each other and just trying to get our voices heard. And then you get that at the very end. I do have to give credit to Arcane though. That part where it accelerandos and gets faster was actually their suggestion. They were like we get to this part and it feels like we are frustrated, but how do we go more? How do we go past it? And so listen to this version. And then they played it for me, and they added an accelerando, and then on top of it there's kind of really loud and kind of angry multiphonics that get kind of played and interjected through this groove that I set up. And that was also their idea. They were like, what do you think of these multiphonics? Originally I had just written trills, but I think in my mind I was thinking do something angry, And so they did. They were like, okay, here's some angry multiphonics that we can make. And that kind of collaboration is what I love about working kind of, creating music in real time, is that you can have the musicians, sometimes they're like, this would be fun to play and sound cool. Let's try it. And then usually I end up putting it in the, in the piece. And so, yeah, as it kind of keeps going, as the movement moves on towards the end, have all these lines that get introduced in the movement. And then by the end, each kind of instrument takes one of those lines and is trying to like make that the most important. And when they were playing it was funny too. They definitely were really good musicians and were trying to find the like, this person has the melody and we'll make sure that they're like, prominent in this, the prominent voice in this texture. And I was like, no, everyone's important. Everyone try to be louder. Everyone try to be louder than everyone else. And then,
Yes.
by the time you get to that little, the very last thing, it's just like, everyone's just screaming at each other. And like, then it, just ends abruptly because how else do you end an argument,
Yeah, well, an argument of that nature, at least.
Yes.
Yeah, certainly. And so then I find it, I'm not 100% sure what to think of movement four. And what I mean by that is how it emotionally fits, because I find the word that you use very interesting, wariness. Wariness for movement four. Now, movement four is also pretty up tempo, as movement three is, but it's a lot cleaner, in the orchestration of it. And I can probably guess that you wanted to move away from the multiple voices climbing over each other sort of idea into something that is a little bit more finely and thinly in some parts structured. And so when I say it's a simple movement, what I mean by that is that there's no like ball busting moment. It's a very it's a very clean movement after something that was incredibly messy right before. And so can you talk a bit about movement four, but specifically, describe wariness and how that fits into this. I find that specific word very fascinating.
Yes. So originally I had titled that fourth movement weariness. So this idea of like, weary is meaning like you've just done something exhausting and like you're just exhausted. And so I was like that, after having a yelling, a screaming match, right? You would be exhausted and kind of like you're just done and tired. And sometimes when you think about the future, you're like, you get to a point where you're like, I can't think of anything. There's nothing I can do. I'm only one person. And like, it's exhausting, right? Having those crazy emotions and just thinking about the future can be very exhausting. And anxieties can be very exhausting. And so that's where I initially was like, okay, I'm gonna write this movement. And then as I wrote it, the meaning changed slightly in that I don't know, I guess I was like, part of it was I did still have that feeling of exhaustion in there, but it was more of like wariness. So like kind of cautiously moving forward is kind of where I kind of drew that word. Because I was thinking of, okay, we just had the screaming match and like we can't just go back, right? There's no going back. And so the only thing we can do is move forward. But with everything that just happened, we have to move forward with that kind of, cautiously moving forward. And it kind of ties into to a little bit later into the last movement of, which is optimism. And so I wanted that idea of sometimes I have the tendency to just be blindly optimistic. And so kind of in thinking about the future, it's helped me kind of, that maybe not helped me, but it's definitely changed my optimism to be more like a cautious optimism, right? And so I wanted wary, oh yeah, I wanted wariness to be, maybe I'm saying it backwards, wary and weary. Anyways, you get the idea.
I honestly, I'm not 100% sure the specific Differences of such. So I'm glad.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but it is, so long story short, it is kind of a play on words, the title of the movement. So weariness and wariness, right? They're very close in saying, and I kind of like try to clump them together. Like, so that movement is a bit more of like a connection into optimism in the sense that we're trying to move forward cautiously. And I think that is weariness and wariness is when you're tired, but the audience
Sure.
shouldn't, yeah, they'll get it. They can Google.
Yes, they can.
But the, I don't know, I guess ask ChatGPT.
Thank you for that setting of that. And so then, how you express optimism at the end, movement five. One thing I was just, well, I thought about this before when I was listening to it, is that you have like, not that he owns this, but it's just something that pops into mind, like John Williams-esque, like soaring melody sort of vibe going on with Movement Five. It's if you just did a little character piece and called it optimism, it would probably be criticized for being a little too cheesy. Like it's just, but in the context of this piece, it is certainly a contrast from previous movements. It's almost like movie-esque in some of its textures for a little bit in how it treats its melody. It's very naturally flowing. And so how about this? Yeah, take this out. You can describe this musically or with whatever issues you have in your mind or in your life. How do you reach that optimism without it feeling? How do you earn that optimism almost? Just like I said, musically, if you're just optimistic without going through the trial and the tribulation musically throughout this piece, or personally and emotionally, it can sometimes feel cheap. You may still have an underlying, just like if you just did a piece called Optimism, which I'm sure someone can do just fine. But, this means a lot more when it comes after the trial and tribulation, musically and emotionally. How do you find that optimism?
Yeah, I think I don't know where it comes to, if it's just as like from my upbringing. I've really seen kind of where my, especially now that I'm older, you know, I think back to my childhood and I think of like where my parents started and how they have been able to, you know, grow a life for their family and then create opportunities for their children. And like I'm the first person in my family to ever earn a doctorate. And so and I'm, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do any of that if it weren't for like the hard work of and the sacrifices of my parents and my family and you know everyone who's kind of supported me along the way. And so I think where my optimism comes from is that seeing how much struggle a person can go through but still kind of have and build a life. You know, it's kind of it's a little bit cheesy, and sometimes it's not a good thing anymore. But I know, you know, the American dream, right, is like this concept that a lot of us grew up with, and I would say that I did get to experience my parents kind of really build that American dream for you know me and my and their family and all of you know my siblings. And so I think looking back and just kind of understanding that. You know, we can't do this alone. It takes, you know, we have to kind of come together. I think as I've gone through my, you know, and as I continue to go through my career and through music, definitely, like we talked about, I've found that community in music that is coming together and is trying to make change happen. And yeah, it's going to be messy along the way, as seen in the other movements. But, you know, I think if you think about the trajectory of a lot of the things that have happened in kind of my own lifetime, or if I think about things that have happened in my own lifetime, you know, it's only gotten better. Yes, there's been, like, you know, fires along the way and a lot of heartache and a lot of sadness and a lot of pain. But in the end, like, I can only say that things have always gotten better. And so I wanted to end this piece with that feeling of it will get better. You know, even coming out of the last moment where it's cautious, you still can be optimistic and can still, because without that optimism, you know, you don't really know if you can, like, what's the point of moving forward? What's the point of trying to fight for something if you don't have that kind of optimism to hope for something better and work for something better and, you know, kind of bring that all into, make all the pain that happened before worth it in the end. And so when I was writing, that last movement, I almost just, you know, I just sat at the piano and kind of improvised for a little bit, and then came up with kind of the melodies and the lines that you hear. And it was just me kind of letting go of everything that happened before, right? And just thinking about moving forward and thinking about kind of all the positive things that have happened in my life and highlighting those and understanding, you know, contextually what happened around all those positive things, but understanding that in the end it is all positive, right?
Sure. Thank you for that. You know, I like to get, sometimes I get criticized by this. I would say sometimes it's rightfully so, by some of my peers, or maybe in some of my analysis, that I go pretty deep into the philosophical or emotional level on music, and sometimes not the deep technical, which has its pluses and its minuses, but I always find that the most fascinating. Before we move on to the final segment of the podcast, is there anything else that you want to say specifically with Uncharted, the process, any of the movements, the overall message, the emotions, whatever you would like?
Wow, that's a big question.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I think in general, if, you know, if someone's going through something, I always find it very therapeutic to listen. It doesn't even have to be, like, you know, Uncharted. It could be like any piece or any, it could be a pop tune or something that just really speaks to you, and that really helps kind of process your emotions. And that's, I think, what Uncharted did for me. And for a lot of people that I've talked to that have listened to it or played it, is that you are almost forced to just kind of process those emotions. And I think it's good to do that. You know, I'm very much a person who likes to just kind of shove my emotions under a carpet. And so I think in music, I found that I can process those emotions, and it's not as scary. And so I think the title, I guess we didn't really talk about the title, Uncharted. I guess it lends to the idea of, you know, uncharted waters. The future is definitely uncharted waters. And I think sometimes, you know, uncharted can be things that you don't, you know, it could be uncharted emotions that you have just been putting off to the side or anything. I just hope that anyone who does, you know, either listen to the piece or play the piece, that it does kind of allow you to go through something and experience and learn and grow, and hopefully it can bring more people together.
Always the hope. Always the hope. So now we're coming to the final segment of this podcast, which we always start with a beautifully broad question, which is, what does music mean to you professionally? Or, well, professionally, it's a way of making a living, but I suppose, just personally, what does music mean to you in your life? You kind of gave a little bit of it previously.
Yeah.
But
yeah, definitely for me, it's been a way from, it's kind of ironic that I'm doing a podcast, because I'm definitely someone who has a hard time expressing kind of their thoughts and ideas and And I think, and probably that's part of it might be coming from growing up with three languages in a household. But when it comes to kind of forming sentences and forming ideas and really trying to get at the root of what I want to say, I have a terrible time kind of trying to doing that. And so I found that in music, it's the only space where I can express myself fully. Like I feel like I'm not hiding anything. I feel like I'm not getting lost in translation, or I'm not getting kind of my words mixed up or anything. Weariness and weariness. And I just, for me, that's what has music has opened up for me. And I mean, obviously music has opened up a world of opportunities for myself as well, meeting amazing people like yourself and talking about your previous guest, Nadine, getting to and just countless of other musicians I've worked with, written for, played with, and it's just been the source of community and source of camaraderie and just an air a space where yeah I feel like I can be myself and express myself fully. And then kind of out of the philosophical, it's like music also is universal in the sense that all cultures have a form of music. We can relate to each other through music. I've played with musicians where we've never kind of formally said a word to each other because we don't speak the same language, but somehow we pull off a whole concert together. And so that's kind of the magic, I guess, that is in music.
Certainly is, and I appreciate the compliment. It's very nice to interact and collaborate with yourself as well. And speaking of community, what are your thoughts and feelings? How do you see the current landscape of composition, whether that's in academics, outside of it, on the performance stage, outside of the performance hall? How do you see composition right now?
Yeah, I mean, one of my kind of idols as far as clarinetist composers, I have several. I mean, I should name all of them, but anyways, the one person who said this was Jonathan Russell. He said anyone can compose, and that kind of really changed. It really hit me hard because when I was younger, I was playing clarinet in band, and I'd never been really formally trained in composition in high school, or kind of leading up into college. And then, but I had always been writing when I was younger. I can remember as far as back as my first band piece was in sixth grade. And so I think from that I went into college, and I had previously spoken to you that someone had found me hunched over my computer composing, and they're like, "Hey, you should probably join the composition studio. Your music's pretty cool." And then I was like, "No, I don't compose." And just
Yeah.
like being afraid to kind of own that. And even after studying, I had three composition teachers, and I've written several pieces now and still my music. And even to this day, I still have a bit of myself that has that imposter syndrome of oh, but I'm technically just a clarinetist. But it's like, no, a lot of my part a huge part of my kind of living right now is composing. And so when he said that, it kind of made it kind of demystified kind of this title of composer for me. And so I think that's one aspect of the compositional landscape that I think I would like to see a bit more change, is that sometimes it is that kind of exclusive club. You have to earn your badge of you are now officially a composer. It's like, but no, literally anyone can write. And I think what's cool is that in pop music, that's also very prevalent. You don't have to be signed to a record label, or you can just, some people have their music go viral just on social media and kind of gain traction from there and grow a following that way. And I think the same can kind of go for art music and art, more of the composition. Like when we think of formal compositions, right? We think of more art, the art music side. We don't think pop musicians as composers, but yeah, or like, or whoever writes their music, sometimes, they have music written for them and they just perform it. But I think, yeah, this just building this notion that anyone can compose. Yes, like, are some composers, like, are some compositions going to be better than others? I mean, I even have some compositions that I'm like, you really want to play that one, So I think, like, you just never know what music will speak to a person. But and yeah, obviously studying it and training and learning more and all that's great, but at the end of the day, when you have a piece that you're really proud of and you've written, and no reason not to kind of put it out there in the world.
Sure. And I really like what you said specifically with, pop artists as composers. I have a pretty loose way of using definitions, which is not always very helpful in scholarship. But like, for example, when you talk about counterpoint, I see almost everything as some level of counterpoint at some fundamental level. But counterpoint really is referring to a specific style of note-to-note combinations from a certain type of, like, that's the technical version. But I see all kinds of music has counterpoint fundamentally because it's musical lines interacting. I see composition the same way. I think I brought this up to you before, and any regular listeners of the show or people who know me personally, I love pop music so incredibly dearly. It's what I primarily like to study and just listen to. And I told my, and this is segmenting into the next question. I recently, actually on the first day of classes with my songwriting class that I teach at Florida State University, I told the students very plainly that you need music theory for songwriting, but songwriting is not music theory. And, songwriting, composition, I would put composition in there instead of songwriting, depending on who talking to. But to me, it's all composition. To me, it's, well, it's not all, they're not all songs, but it's all writing. I see that as one and the same. There's different connotations to each, just like earlier we were talking about anger, frustration, so on. Should those connotations be there? That's an entire other conversation, and usually gets into like elitism, in my opinion, at least. But segueing into music theory. So I just said that for, that you need music theory for composition, but composition is not music theory. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe more just broadly, your thoughts on music theory as an institution and its interactions in and around composition.
Yeah, I mean, going to, go, obviously I've gone through like the music theory classes and analyze music and everything, and I would say that it definitely has informed a lot of my music. But when it comes to kind of composition, I'll tell you a quick funny story is that as I was going through music theory, so I'd be writing compositions and then I'd be like, wow, this is really cool. Like, oh, you can't like do parallel fifths, right? Or whatever. And then I wrote and I was like, let me write a piece of like all parallel fifths and like just have it moving around. And oh, this sounds really cool. I'm inventing something. And then, lo and behold, it's just called planing, like Debussy. And like, and so it just like me constantly doing that of just like, discovering that what I was writing and then, oh, that like how that technique or like that kind of thing I did compositionally has an analysis or like it has kind of like it has a name for it. And so that's that's been kind of how I went through music theory. It was just like always relating it in with composition. And now just understanding like, oh, that's why I like how I did this in my composition. But I would say like even when I'm composing, sometimes I would say majority of the time I'm not like I'm not like going, okay, I want a five chord here and then I want to like I want to go to a four chord but in second inversion. I'm not really like thinking of that. I'm more yeah thinking like quote unquote like counterpoint or the lines, right? I'm really thinking of the lines and how they're interacting with each other and then what harmonies kind of result in that, and then is the harmony like what I want and like is it flowing correctly. But I would say that when it comes to like music theory, I definitely at one point like I was like maybe I want to be like go into music theory and like that was like kind of the route I wanted to go into. But I think I had more fun writing the music than analyzing my music. But I think it's important to have music theorists out there, because then, when you have, sometimes you have composers that, like, they've written something, but they're not quite, and I've run into this where I'm not quite sure, like, why it works, or like why it fits that way. Like, I'll spend hours just kind of like playing a chord and trying to get it to the next chord, and I'm just like, that doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel right. And like keep playing back and forth between two different chords and how the spacing works out. And when I finally, find it, then in hindsight, I kind of look back and I'm like, oh yeah, that's my voice leading here. And like, oh, that's like, that's kind of, and then kind of zooming out too, just like, oh, and then that chord leads into this one. And it's like, now you have a good progression here, X, Y, Z. And so I would say when it comes to, yeah, music theory and composition, it's definitely, how do I want to say this? They're coupled in a way that it's like they're a symbiotic relationship. That's what I wanted to say. So like, yeah, like definitely music theory, like composition, they have a very symbiotic relationship.
I would agree, but then I would also disagree that that's actually what's happening. In that, in my perspective, I completely agree with you. It is highly symbiotic. For there to be music theorists, there needed to be and needs to be composers. Someone has to write the music. But I would argue, other than in an academic setting of like peers helping each other, are there truly that many music theorists looking at music that is currently being written? I'm not trying to like put myself out from the crowd, but I get a feeling that that is not that everyone is analyzing old dead white European guys, but that's, throughout the history of theory, that's the majority. And I would still say now maybe 50%. There's a lot of popular music going on, and newer music for music theory is still like in the 50s and 60s and 70s. With exceptions, of course. There's some people doing some great work. Judy Lockhead, in particular, I really like. But again, I'm 23 in my second year of my master's. It's not like I have a grand scope of perspective. I just don't feel the love for modern composition in academic. Well, music theory is academic. I don't feel it in music theory, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true in the sense that, I have my the story I always think about is, in at least in the clarinet world, right? The music that's like written today is considered, right, contemporary music, right? That contemporary means like of this day. And so there was like a when I was going into like graduate auditions, there was one audition I took, and I was playing a contemporary piece. The composer was alive. It was a piece I was learning, and it had, kind of extended techniques and stuff like that. And the person kind of was like, "Oh, why are you studying that? You should play like real contemporary music, like Stravinsky." And I was like,
Oh, yeah, okay.
I was like, "Okay, sure. Stravinsky is definitely contemporary music. Okay."
Agreed.
And then, obviously didn't study there, but that was like. That's definitely like I think still rings true today, that I still find people saying Stravinsky's contemporary music, and I'm just like,
Honestly, the joke I hear about is Schoenberg is contemporary, but Stravinsky even? Really?
yeah.
Like that's not to Stravinsky's awesome, but like really,
Yeah.
that's not contemporary.
Yeah. I mean, not discounting Stravinsky at all, because yeah, his music definitely like was very transformative and kind of revolutionary, but there's also a lot more revolutionary things happening today. I mean, I saw there's this really cool piece where it's like, it's a, again, a clarinet piece, just because I'm a clarinetist, but it's Eric Mandat. He has this device that you can like attach to yourself, so that you can, it's a, you're playing, and then depending on your movements, right, it triggers like different things electronically. And so it's like, I think it uses like a Xbox Kinect, and like that's how it tracks your movement and like your and it's like all this spatial stuff. And so like there's like, that is like cool. Like, how do you, like that would be amazing for like a music theorist to just kind of like, okay, let's like dissect this. Like, how do we just like dissect this? And like now it's like, combination of things. Not only is it like music, it's, you have the electronic aspects, you have then this like movement aspect, and it's more Like, and that, and the movement is music. Like, you are making music with your movement. So that's a whole nother kind of realm of just, we don't have any tools to analyze that, you know? So it's like, that would be a great, like, kind of, music theorist thing. Like, someone had to create, Roman numerals. Someone had to create like 12 tone analysis. Someone should create like Xbox Kinect analysis, you know? So I think, like, yeah, definitely you had brought up this idea of elitism, and I think definitely kind of going through, the whole gamut of academia, that is very much prevalent, in that I think it's academia, not to like kind of be shadow banned by academia, but like I feel like they are kind of holding on to those remnants of elitism, because they've set it up where they have to, in that, if it's, it ha you have to like prove your worth to be studied, in a sense. Like, it's like there's but how do you prove your worth when it's something like brand new, and when it hasn't been, it quote unquote stood the test of time? And I think that's why they hang on to like analyzing older music, is because, oh, it stood the test of time. We don't know if this new stuff is going to like be here in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years,
Sure, yeah.
So.
And recently, and I'm going to keep their identity a mystery out of respect. Recently, I had a very great conversation with one of my professors. And I was essentially asking them, because doctoral school PhD program applications are coming up for myself. And I showed them the theorist composer collaboration. I said, I'm really interested and analyzing pop music and contemporary music, which, as I said to them, that doesn't mean anything, the contemporary part. Because, contemporary music could be a Reed Quintet or Xbox Kinect analysis. Like it that
Yes.
and that's the beauty of it too, is that there's just so much variety in every single capacity. That's part of the beauty of it. But I was showing them the TCC, not that this is going to be like my main thing, but how do I take these skills and these perspectives? And I have a handful of pieces that I really want to dive in depth, some that have been featured on this podcast, to like study and make conference proposals and like really make scholarship out of it. And bless their heart, because they were so supportive, but they were being very real in that to be a viable job candidate and PhD applicant, you can't have that broad contemporary music be your flagship as but and that's just the reality. And this person, not to, in the past couple of years, just went off the job market, and bless them, they're doing a great job. And in the past handful of years, and they were very honest, that it's not going to work, or that really limits yourself. But and that's not to speak ill of them, because then we talked about how I can incorporate that into my application and how this is a great thing for so and so and so. But they were very supportive in how I can incorporate that part of myself. But that is just the reality of it. And that's something we got to contend with. That leads to the panic from the first movement.
Yes, to come full circle, or yeah,
Yes, it
it's
comes to come full circle. So yeah, again, not to speak, that was a beautiful, I had a great conversation with that professor, but that's how it is. It
yeah,
just,
it mm-hmm.
yeah,
Yeah,
go
I would
ahead.
definitely, yeah, I was gonna say, like, yeah, and in some cases you have to, I mean, not to say that we're all playing a game, but like, you sometimes you have to play the game, right? You have to follow the rules and do the thing if you wanna kind of have a shot at being able to do something, like make change later, in a sense, right? So I think the important thing is to like never lose sight of your first kind of, like why you're doing it. And I think that's kind of my biggest thing I've discovered recently, is like you just have to hang on to like why you're doing it, and no matter what kind of hoops you're jumping through, and hoops you have to jump through to kind of make it, as long as you hang on to your why, wherever you end up, like that's as long as that's kind of your salient guiding light, then anything you do in your career, anything that you kind of develop, will always lead back to your true self and like your true why you started doing it. And so for me, like, why I started composing and why I continued, this like life as a musician, even though like, everyone says, there's no money in music and blah blah blah, and like it's the hard one of the hardest degrees and also one of the hardest like careers to kind of just have. My passion for just like keeping how it made me feel going through it alive and passing that on to my students and kind of creating a world where it is better and it continues to improve. And then like that's why I can, I continue to write music and why I continue to teach and why I continue to perform is because it's all moments where I can kind of make small changes, whether it be just, saying, have being a person that looks like myself and someone who may not see other people like that look like them on stage. That has been like a big thing for me of meeting, other musicians that are also, come from a diverse background or just even, sometimes it's just, they're like, oh, you're part Filipino, like I am too. And then you're kind of connecting in that way. And then even in my music too, just like highlighting things, and working with musicians that, maybe don't have a chance to have music written for them or, whatever it is. I think it's easy to have people say no to you and then kind of give up. But I think, yes, let them say no to you, but and kind of, kind of shuffle around and do what you need to as far as like the game. And then when you have your opportunity to start injecting your why back into what you do, then that's kind of all you can do. And eventually all those little moments, all those little changes you can like add in will add up. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing right now, especially even in people I know in academia that feel that same way, right? They played the game, they got the job, and now they're trying to slowly change it.
Sure. All to bring it back to, the theme of the last movement, hope and looking forward, So, now we're coming to the close of this podcast, but so it sounds like you have a very light work schedule, but I ask you, of course that's a joke, but I ask you, what are what's next for you? What's going on? I have big projects coming up, things looking off in the horizon.
Yes, I've mentioned it. It's like sometimes I don't like to think about all the projects coming up because it gets a little overwhelming. I start to panic. And so, but yeah, no, I've got like I'm working on a couple commissions for this. There's this it's called Low Clarinet Fest, and it's happening here in Glendale. It's run by or was conceived by Stephanie Gardner, and she's a amazing clarinetist and really a pioneer in low clarinets as bass clarinet playing. Not only that, but just as a clarinetist teacher and kind of a community leader and just everything. And so I have a couple pieces that are being premiered at Low Clarinet Fest. Still currently writing them actually, so need to get those done. But it's for yeah, so for low clarinets, and then I've got a couple more commissions lined up for next year, like a clarinet flute duet, and then I'm actually working with the Rhode Island Recording Ensemble, or known as RYRE, to write a clarinet concerto with written for young band. So it's going to be a soloist with the intention of a young band accompanying them. And so that's will be in the summer, and then after that, I've gotten hopefully I'm planning to do a short concert of my music at Clarinet Fest, and hopefully being joined by other people who have commissioned me in the past. So I think it's a lot of really great things to look forward to, and then obviously just trying to manage my studio, my small army of students, and yeah, and then I've got like a few exciting things coming up on my website, a few launches of of different things that I can't really get into right now, but it's coming up. And I guess by the time this podcast is out, everyone will know what I'm talking about.
Cool. Plenty of things coming up. I feel you with that, where if I think about my upcoming projects, it starts to put me in the cycle of the Uncharted piece of panic and so on,
Yes.
when so much is coming up, but it all sounds like great things. And so what would be the best way for the audience to contact you for any comments, questions, or if you still have any slots for commissions?
Yes. The best place to kind of find everything about me is on my website, which is fjdmusic.com. Sorry, I'll say that better. fjdmusic.com. Other than that, I am slowly but surely trying to grow a little bit more of a community on Instagram, so they can find me at Paco de Alba 33, and that's all, at Paco de Alba 33 altogether. I mainly just share my like stuff that happens in my career. I share kind of just advice that I thought that or advice that I wish someone would have told me as I was going through like trying to find my way through music and a career in music and even just music school in general. And then also I like just like vlog my day sometimes. So you'll see some kind of fun little vlogs here and there. I'm on Facebook. My email is contact@fjdmusic.com, and I'm sure you'll link that somewhere. Yeah, and so there's plenty of places to find me, and I'd love to connect with pretty much anyone, and it could be music theorists, could be non-music, it can be clarinets, any instruments. I primarily talked about a lot of like clarinet writing and stuff that's coming up, but I've got like tenor saxophone that I've got slotted to, and like that flute piece that I'm writing, and I write for pretty much anything. I'd love to connect with musicians who are passionate about just creating a community and hopefully an optimistic future.
Oh yes, for sure, an optimistic future. And I like that that's basically the theme of this episode, optimism in the future. And
Yes.
so we're coming to the actual close of the episode now. And before I ask the last question or prompt you for, I want to say thank you for your time. To everyone listening, it will have been very thoroughly cut out to the best of my ability, but apartment maintenance person, after a month and a half of waiting, it's not his fault. He's a great guy. It's the apartment complex's fault, has finally arrived in the middle of the recording. So thank you for your patience
Oh,
with
yeah,
that.
no worries at all.
Not having a dishwasher for a month and a half can be not fun when you have two working adults. But anyways, anyhow, let's get back to this. So, to leave off, I'm going to give you the last note. If you had to say anything to the audience about music, life, personal struggles, we've talked about a fair amount. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, let me get a good cough in.
Cool.
I guess I'm not used to talking so much. I feel like it's just so easy to talk to you, and it's been such great conversation. And again, I just really appreciate you having me on.
Of course, of course.
And yeah, to anyone listening, or especially for those listening, and if you're thinking about the future, and if you're in trying to think about a career in music or going to music school, I want to offer this little piece of encouragement in that when you have enough passion for something that you really love, kind of just trust in that, and everything else will follow. My dad, he was a big proponent of the idea of that, when you do what you love, the money will follow. And at times, I definitely going through music school and like kind of working odd jobs and just trying to like make ends meet on my own. I definitely kind of would have lost sight of that if it weren't for my dad. And I think now, thinking of where I am and just hanging on to my passion for music, I'm able to travel the world, sharing my music, meet amazing musicians, perform my music, and just do stuff that I couldn't have ever imagined that I'd be able to do. And all that's because I kind of hung on some of the passion I had for music. And so if you're listening, like, I think just really trust in your passions and just keep fighting for that future that you want. And yeah, everything will always get better.
I love it. Everything will always get better. That's the hope. It is.
Yes.
Anyways, okay. Well, this has been the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I want to thank the audience for their time. And of course, thank you, Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba, or Dr. Paco de Alba, or Dr. Paco. You have many, many different possibilities, but however, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming on to here. It's been a great conversation.
Very welcome. Yes, this has been really awesome. Thank you.
Hello, this is Aaron again, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba for coming onto the podcast and for sharing his piece Uncharted. Dr. Paco's contact info is listed in the description. I would appreciate it if you could show him some support. This was a fantastic episode with a whole bunch of different elements. One of my favorite, maybe because it just hit so close to home, is the talk of career anxiety. Now, I'm not saying that career anxiety is really my favorite thing, but maybe it is possibly the most widely applicable to a lot of people our age. And as I said in the episode, I'm coming very dangerously, oh so soon, close to a doctoral application season, and career anxiety is certainly one term to describe this time. Dr. Paco's perspective on all the different topics that we discuss, all the different elements of expression in music and conveying these different kinds of dynamic and, quite frankly, very common emotions between all of us, it was a very special time. And I just want to give a very special thank you once again to Dr. Francisco Javier de Alba for coming onto the podcast and for sharing his piece, Uncharted. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you can click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. I'm excited to promote that our next featured composer will be Catherine Bergman and her piece Land of Cloud-Tinted Water. There will be more information on this in the upcoming blog post and, of course, in the next full episode. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss it. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.